Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for tuning in for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Nick Garfinkel. On June 21st, 2021, the Supreme Court decided United States v. Arthrex, Inc., a case which concerned the constitutionality of the Patent Trial and Appeal Board's authority to appoint administrative patent judges. Writing for the 5-4 majority, Chief Justice Roberts concluded that the unreviewable authority wielded by APJs during inter-parties review is incompatible with their appointment by the Secretary of Commerce to an inferior office, thereby vacating the lower court's judgment and remanding for further review. Three experts join us today to discuss the ruling. They are Professor Kristen Osenga, the Austin E. Owen Research Scholar and Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law, Professor Dimitri Karstedt, Associate Professor of Law at the George Washington Law School, and Professor Gregory Dolan, Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director at the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law.
Thanks, Nick. As Nick mentioned, I'm Kristen Osenga, and I'm joined today by two of my friends, Greg Dolan from the University of Baltimore School of Law and the judging part of Palau, and Dimitri Karstedt from the George Washington Law School. So as Nick mentioned, today we are covering the Supreme Court's decision in the United States versus Arthrex case that was handed down on Monday, which is June 21st. I'm going to provide a very short background, and then Greg and Dimitri will explain the various opinions. And there were four opinions in this case and 72 pages written. So there's a lot to talk about. After they lay down the decisions and the positions of the various justices, we're going to talk about who's right, who's wrong, and what the larger implications this decision may have for patent law, for administrative law, and beyond. As Nick mentioned also, at the end of our discussion, there should be some time for questions, and we'll let you know how to get your questions to our panelists. So this case started out as a patent dispute, specifically when Smith and Nephew and Arthrocare filed a petition for inter-parties review of a patent owned by Arthrex. So the inter-parties review procedure at issue in this case was part of the Leahy-Smith American Invents Act of 2011. And what that is it's a quasi-judicial procedure within the patent office that allows third parties to challenge the validity of issued patents. Superficially, the petitioner asks the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, PTAB, to consider whether one or more claims of an issued patent owned by someone else is valid, and the director of the Patent and Trademark Office decides whether to institute one of these inter-parties review proceedings. If it's instituted, then a three-judge panel, usually, of administrative patent judges, or PTAB judges, or APJs, will then conduct the inter-parties review in a quasi-judicial way. After the panel hears the evidence, it will make a decision, and the board will issue a final written decision determining the patentability of the challenge claims. And then after a period for appeal has passed, the director of the patent office will issue a certificate canceling any claims the board determines to be unpatentable. So in this case, Smith and Nephew petitioned for an inter-parties review that was instituted. A three-judge panel of PTAB judges determined that a number of claims of the patent belonging to Arthrex were invalid and unpatentable, and the board issued its final written decision. Arthrex then appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for Federal Circuit and argued that the appointment of the judges that heard the inter-parties review were not constitutionally appointed. So the United States Constitution provides that principal officers must be appointed by the president with the advice and consent of Senate, while inferior officers can be appointed by the president or courts of law or heads of departments. So the PTAB judges who hear these inter-parties reviews are appointed by the Secretary of Commerce in consultation with the director of the Patent Office. And so Arthrex argued that these PTAB judges, based on the authority they hold and the functions they do, were principal officers, and because they were not, appointed by the president with advice and consent of Senate. They were unconstitutionally appointed, and so therefore these inter-parties reviews are unconstitutional. The Federal Circuit agreed with Arthrex's argument, holding that the APJs were indeed principal officers. And to solve the dilemma of having this entire body, the PTAB, being unconstitutionally composed, the Federal Circuit severed the removal protection that had been given to the APJs in an effort to make them look more like inferior officers and preserve the rest of the inter-parties scheme. Not surprisingly, nobody was happy about this. Each of the government, Smith and Nephew, and Arthrex requested rehearing en banc unsuccessfully at the Federal Circuit. And then each of those parties filed a petition for cert at the Supreme Court, seeking review of various aspects of the Federal Circuit's decision. The Supreme Court granted cert to determine whether the PTAB and its structure is consistent with the Appointments Clause of the Constitution, and if not, what the appropriate remedies should be. As I mentioned, the decision generated four separate opinions. You might need a Venn diagram for this. I saw one on Twitter this morning that they do exist. Justice Roberts wrote for the majority in a three-part opinion, holding that the appointment of the PTAB judges as inferior officers was incompatible with the authority they have in the patent system. And for those parts of his opinion, he was joined by Justices Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. In the final part of the majority opinion, Roberts wrote that the Federal Circuit's fix, that is, removing the PTAB judge's tenure, was not the solution, and instead that every decision must instead be reviewable. That part of the majority opinion, it was joined by Justices Breyer, Alito, Kavanaugh, Barrett, Sotomayor, and Kagan. So then we have the other opinions. Justice Gorsuch filed an opinion concurring in part, but dissenting as to the remedy. Justice Breyer filed an opinion dissenting as to whether or not this is actually a problem, but agreeing with the remedy if one must be granted, joined by Justices Sotomayor and Kagan. And Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion, joined by Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, as to the non-existence of the problem with the appointment of the PTAB judges. So if that was confusing, good. I explained it exactly right. And now to clear this all up, I'm going to turn to my expert panelists. Greg is going to go first and explain the Roberts majority opinion, as well as the Gorsuch opinion. And then he'll be followed by Dimitri, who will explain the Breyer and Thomas opinions. And then we'll talk about right, wrong, and implications. So Greg, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, Federal Society. It's always a pleasure to be on one of these phone calls. It is a particular pleasure to be with my friends, Kristen and Dimitri, with whom we often agree, sometimes disagree, but always, always come to some sort of new understanding about the legal issues involved. So I'm looking forward to the continuation of this discussion. So Roberts' opinion, as Kristen suggested, comes in two parts because the case came up in two parts. The first question that the court had to wrestle with was whether or not the APJs are principal or inferior officers, given the authority that they exercise, given the statutory scheme that only allows the board, not the director of the patent office, to exercise the power to cancel patents and assigns the director only ministerial duty of shall issue a cancellation certificate or confirmation certificate, or whether or not a director retains sufficient amount of supervision, where although he might have this ministerial duty to issue a certificate, given how he can supervise the board by providing rules, removing judges, adding new judges, etc., ultimately these are just inferior officers. So that was question number one. And question number two was that to the extent the first question was answered in a way to hold that the judges, the APJs, are in fact principal officers, the question is what to do about it. Because to the extent that they are principal officers, everybody agreed that they were not constitutionally appointed. They were not nominated by the president, they were not confirmed by the Senate. So if the court were to conclude that these are principal officers, the question is what to do about it. As I think, like I said, we did a preview of this decision back in December, or I guess post-view of the argument when the case was argued. I think it was argued in December. No, I'm wrong. So it was argued back in, February. It was the briefs were filed in December. So we did it a few months ago when we discussed this case right after the argument, as we, I think, all of us predicted then that it's unlikely that anybody was going to endorse the Federal Circuit remedy of making these APJs removable at will, and ultimately we were right. So Venn diagram notwithstanding, that part was easy. That was a 9-0. No one endorsed the Federal Circuit's remedy. But let's go back to the first questions. Are these principal or inferior officers? And Justice Roberts' opinion is a little bit baffling in my view, because he had an opportunity to draw a clear, bright line. It was advocated by, for example, in an article by Professor Gary Lawson, it was advocated by a brief that I submitted together with Ilya Shapiro for Cato Institute and a number of other amici, where the bright line was that unless there's somebody above you, not merely in title or not merely in sort of in grandeur, but somebody above you who can reverse that very decision that is being contested, you are a principal officer. That's kind of the bright line we proposed. And Chief Justice Roberts' opinion almost kind of gets to this line, but not quite. He seems to hang a lot on this idea that, unlike the case which everybody sort of relied on, both in the concurrence, dissents, and the majority opinion, that case is called Edmonds, which concerned the judges in the United States Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals. All of those judges were appointed by the Secretary of Transportation, also not by the president, not subject to Senate confirmation. The reason the court a number of years ago upheld that arrangement was because an appeal lied from that court to another Article I as opposed to Article III tribunal, whose judges were indeed appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Plus, there was some supervisory power by the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, who could, or the Coast Guard, who could also supervise how the trials or appeals with the Court of Criminal Appeals proceeded. And so Chief Justice Roberts relied heavily on Edmonds, but really emphasized the part of Edmonds that was absent in this case, that there, unlike in Edmonds, there is no higher level tribunal to which PTAB decisions could be appealed to within the executive branch. He could have just stopped there and said, unless there's such a tribunal, such an individual exists, then everybody who exercises the final power or final say on behalf of the United States is in fact a principal officer. But as he got to this line, he pulled back. He left a fair amount of wiggle room to say that there might be other situations where perhaps a more sort of functional approach, a more kind of indirect supervision may be sufficient. It may be that I'm overreading that opinion, but you know, maybe it's just a vintage Justice Roberts where he doesn't have to say, you know, he doesn't like saying more if he can just basically resolve a case in a very narrow ground. But it's just, to me, it seemed odd where, you know, instead of kind of just drawing that one particular strand out of Edmonds, he really, really leaned heavily on that fact of lack of review, and yet didn't say that that is sine qua non of making principal versus inferior officer distinction. But nonetheless, because the majority, a five-justice majority of Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Barrett concluded that this review is sort of absent, that makes APJs principal officers. Which, of course, then led us to question number two. Since if these are principal officers, at least the power they exercise, right, and I guess later on, Dimitri and I will get into debate, is it reasonable to call these APJs principal officers? But let's put it, so let's just to dissect that question for a moment. So if the power that these individuals exercise is the power that can only be exercised by principal officers, then it follows that these individuals cannot exercise that power because they were not appointed as the principal officers would have been appointed, i.e. by the president subject to Senate confirmation. So the question became what to do about it. Again, sort of full disclosure, like I said, I filed a brief on this, and together with a number of other amici, we suggested that there's lots of ways to kind of to square that circle, and different ways have different costs and benefits. So, for example, one way could have been done is to have that sort of second level tribunal, just like a court of appeals for the armed forces, Article One tribunal within the executive branch. It's Article Two tribunal. Another way of doing it is basically have a director have the final say. So a director have a personal, not that he has necessarily to exercise it, but has the power of personal review. Yet another one would be, for example, scrapping the whole process altogether and reassigning the adjudication of patents back to Article Three, where it has been for, you know, 200 some years before AIA, which is ultimately what Justice Gorsuch suggested. So there's lots of way of doing this, and picking one versus the other involves a lot of policy choices. And so a number of Ramesh, myself included, we advocated that the court sort of leave that question alone, not endorse the Federal Circuit remedy, which the court did not, and just kick it back to Congress so Congress can decide which one of these issues they like better. And the reason, for example, we suggested, and I'll get to a moment what the court actually did. So the reason we suggested it that way is because the patent inter-parties review processes and post-grant review processes are kind of a weird animal. On one hand, as the court decided just, I think, two terms ago on oil states, this is a type of procedure that can't constitutionally be done in the executive branch. On the other hand, it was very clear that Congress wanted some sort of neutral adjudicator. They didn't want this decision to be done based on who has the most pull in the administration. And they didn't want, you know, for example, Apple to go, complain to the Secretary of Commerce when this doesn't go their way, to fire the patent office director. There wanted to be some sort of insulation from that type of politics. And it is somewhat hard to square that circle, which is why perhaps for a long time patent adjudication was done by the federal Article III judiciary. It can be done, but it's not easy. And so that's why sort of a number of Misha advocated, let Congress figure out how to properly strike that balance. The five-justice majority, and again, it's a weird five-justice majority, because on the remedy portion, Justice Gorsuch parted ways with a previous five-justice majority on the merits. And so in order to get to any sort of remedy, Justice Breyer, as well as, I guess, Justice Kagan and Sotomayor, had to provide this grudging vote, where it said, like, look, we shouldn't do this anyways, but since we're doing it, I will give you the vote to come to some sort of remedy that's kind of the least worst outcome from Justice Breyer's perspective. So it's a different, a shifting majority on the remedy. And the remedy became that it's the director who will now have the opportunity to review. So kind of if the complaint was, look, there was nobody reviewing these APJs, nobody with the power to vacate their decision, to reverse their decision. Well, now we have that guy, and that guy is going to be director of patent office. Director of patent office is presidentially appointed and Senate confirmed. Problem solved. Of course, like I said, that potentially leads to other problems, because director, of course, is a political animal, politically appointed, politically responsible, not with no tenure protection, fireable at will. And so now we've solved the appointments clause problems, but potentially raised some due process problems as well. I'll stop shortly. I guess one more thing that I wanted to add in terms of, I guess I have to cover Justice Gorsuch's opinion. I'm sorry. So, but one more thing kind of I thought sort of a bit odd about Justice Roberts's opinion is that it reminded me in some sense about, it reminded me of NFIB, where in order to save the statute, because kind of Justice Roberts assumed that Congress would want something rather than nothing, the statute was rewritten. So the way Justice Roberts arrived at his remedy, he said section, I think it's 3B, if I'm correct, section 3B, which limits who can grant rehearings and who can reverse decision to the board itself, he said this section is no longer enforceable as against the director. And the reason I thought that was odd is because usually when you find a section to be unconstitutional, right, you do say, well, that section is unenforceable, and you know, maybe it is severable, maybe it's not. But here it's and said, look, the government can't enforce that section against a particular individual or a particular person can't act. But here, by sort of making that section 3B unenforceable, saying only the board itself can grant rehearings, it's not clear what that means. Because if you take a pencil and just strike that section out, it doesn't mean that anybody else can grant rehearings either. So it becomes somewhat odd, you know, an odd step, as to say, well, this section no longer is enforceable, but, you know, but we're basically going to write a new section. So it's a rewrite of the statute, which Justice Roberts has done a couple of times before, makes it for a bit of a weird adjudication. So in one sense, it's very much judicial modesty. So you do as little as possible. On the other hand, it is huge judicial aggrandizement in basically rewriting the statute. I promise I'll cover Justice Gorsuch. I'll do it very quickly. Justice Gorsuch, like I said, joined the merits opinion, dissented on the remedy. And he spent most of his, and he descended on the remedy for the reason that I already kind of highlighted, that I critique, as to said, look, it's a policy choice, let Congress do it. But he did spend a lot of his time basically lamenting that his view in the case that I already mentioned, oil states, which is a decision, I think, two or three terms ago, where there was a more kind of frontal attack on IPR, saying this entire process is unconstitutional because patents are vested rights and can only be canceled by an Article III judiciary. Justice Gorsuch agreed with that view, but he was on a losing end of a 7-2 majority, interestingly enough, with Justice Roberts. And so he spent a fair amount of his dissent lamenting that the court did not agree with his view in oil states. And again, as somebody who filed a brief in that case as well, urging the court to take the position that Justice Gorsuch ultimately took, so perhaps I'm somewhat partial, but you know, I think there's some force to the argument saying that, look, we made the wrong turn with oil states, and now we're basically trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, and none of the solutions are really good. We're only talking about perhaps the least bad ones. And really where we went wrong is several years ago in oil states. We should have struck it down on the basis that these decisions ought to be made by Article III judiciary, just like they have been for the last 200 odd years. And so that's kind of where Justice Gorsuch came out. I think I've talked long enough, and I think I can turn it over to Dimitri to discuss the dissents, and then we can talk about who's right and who's wrong.
Thanks, Greg. That's awesome. Dimitri, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to the Federalist Society for having me back. I remember the enjoyable discussion we had back in March, I think, right after oral arguments, and you know, predicting that probably you know, this is not going to survive constitutional scrutiny, but at the same time, the whole system isn't going to go down. And I think, you know, everyone's predictions in that regard were correct. And now it's sort of time to discuss the aftermath. So Greg, I think, did a great job of covering kind of the principal opinion, the Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in the case, and the Gorsuch opinion as well. I will talk about the Thomas and Breyer opinions. Actually, so for vote kind purposes, Breyer's opinion is really important because it provided the three key votes for saving the PTAB, right? For basically agreeing with the remedy that the Roberts opinion wrote in, but Gorsuch did not join. So only got, initially got four votes at principle, that part of the principal opinion, and then the Breyer's opinion joined that. So for vote counting, that is an extremely important opinion. But I will start with the Thomas dissent, because that is a principal dissent. And it's not clear actually if Thomas supported the severability analysis. I don't see, given his jurisprudence, you would like that analysis. So I'll start with that. But before sort of I get into the dissents, and you know, I guess dissents by definition are saying the majority was wrong. So there's going to be a little bit of right or wrong already. Kind of the something that struck me out of Greg's presentation. So the move is, you need political accountability. I mean, the reason why appointments clause is so important is you need political accountability. You need, you know, really, really close supervision of these, you know, these officers that are, you know, basically not appointed with advice and consent of the Senate. But wait, you get political supervision, but that creates a potential bias. So we can't have that either, right? So it creates a real conundrum for the design of an administrative system when you say you need political supervision accountability, but then that creates potential for bias. So maybe the end game here is the whole system is illegitimate, and maybe that's the answer, but that's not kind of ultimately how the votes came down. So Breyer's opinion is elaboration of Thomas's opinion. Thomas's opinion is kind of admirably textual to begin with. Thomas began by saying that APJs, PTAB administrative patent judges, are inferior because they have superiors. And just textually, they have multiple superiors. They have the director and they have the secretary of commerce. They're really somewhat low on a totem pole of the administrative state and this, you know, Department of Commerce. And it's not even clear if they supervise anyone at all, right? So they, kind of write decisions for themselves. There's examiners, there is primary examiners and so on. It's not clear if APJs supervise anyone. So they seem to be fairly inferior officers just in their status within the agency. So that's Thomas's first point. The second point is sort of harkening back to these cases. Greg mentioned one, Edmund, and other cases, Morrison, is that framers actually provided very little guidance on the line between inferior officers and principal officers. They provided some mechanisms for appointment for inferior officers, including even the courts. But other than that, so there's some process guidance, but not really a substantive guidance as to what constitute the features of one or the other. And sort of a theme in both the Thomas and Abari's opinions is that given so little guidance and given lack of clear lines, maybe we should just defer to Congress in most, but really, really clear, egregious cases of, you know, Secretary of State bypassing the advice and consent process or something like that, because it's just not clear what the line is. All right. So, and I think kind of the majority in the end is defensible in stare decisis purposes, because Edmund did say, right, that an important factor in deciding principal versus inferior line is sort of having the final word for the agency. And Thomas has a lot to say about that in a part of the opinion that only he wrote, sort of historical analysis. But the part that the four justices joined in dissent basically just says, right, as a matter of constitutional text, as a matter of function, it's just not clear if APJs play the function of principal officers. So what are the mechanisms of supervision, right? So as Greg said, right, just grandeur is not enough. You know, I'm signing a paycheck and that's it. But there's actually a lot of supervision here, right? So directors can initiate a rulemaking. So for example, a claim construction, should the APJs use broadest reasonable interpretation standard for claim construction versus a Phillips standard? That is a huge mechanism of control. Ex ante and so on, right? The directors can have a precedential opinion panel. They can basically take an opinion by, you know, APJs, and the director can compose a panel of himself or herself, and then the commissioner of patents and the deputy AP or the chief judge of the PTAB, and basically write that into the PTO precedent. And yes, it sort of smacks a little bit of stacking. We'll talk about that more, but that's something else the director can do to control how PTAB judges do their jobs, right? And of course, there's besides ex ante control, there actually is ex post control too, right, of substantive opinions. They can, the director can take a regular PTAB opinion and then through the rehearing process, right, basically establish it into precedent, reverse it, and so on. And yes, again, that would require a director putting himself on the PTAB panel along with the commissioner of patents and the chief APJ, but that has been done. And I was just looking at recent, it's called PAPA, Presidential Opinion Panel cases, and it's done quite a bit, and it can involve a reversal of the panel, as well as, right, kind of creation of rules ex ante for the PTAB judges to follow. So that is a lot of supervision, right? A lot of supervision. And the majority just sort of, the majority response seems to say, well, there's a due process problem to it. It's not clear if sole review by the director is any better from the due process purposes at creating a panel of three, but we can leave it at that. But it's sort of, you know, as far as supervision is concerned, there is a ton of supervision within the PTO already. Then Thomas goes on and makes some more textual points. You know, nothing about the appointment of APJs was improper. They were appointed by the Secretary of Commerce, right, which is a department head and so on. To the extent that the chain of command is broken, right, to the extent that there isn't, an intervening decision by the agency head, somehow the director, that violation, that line is broken every time that there is an independent agency, right? So for example, the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, which Greg mentioned, is not accountable to the president. Those judges aren't appointed by the sitting president. They supervise the VA, Veterans Administration, that is true, but they're not accountable to the president. They're an independent entity, right? So that chain of command is broken in administrative state constantly. So I guess what is happening is, right, so there's sort of this interplay between the vesting clause, which is that ensures a chain of command, and the appointments clause. And Thomas's accusation is sort of the majority's drawing the line between the two and sort of trying to deduce this new power. And I think the dig at the end of the opinion joined by four justices is quite remarkable. It says, I would not be so quick to stare deeply into the penumbras of the clauses to identify new structural limitations. Of course, that calls back penumbras and emanations analysis of Justice Douglas and opinions like Griswold. And that's exactly what Thomas is accusing the majority of doing here, right? So it stands to reason, like, sort of to take this accusation to heart, because the Court of Appeals to Veterans Claims is one example that Roberts uses of executive branch control. And by the way, right, examiner decisions and ex parte proceedings, which have been around for a long time, if there's a rejection, it's not appealable to the director either, right? It goes to the PTAB. So we'll see maybe some further developments where maybe our ex parte examination process with appeals to the PTAB that then go to the Federal Circuit is also legitimate. But that's the way it's been done for a long time. And remember, right, the Court of Customs of Patent Appeals, became an Article III court in 1958, right? So you got a direct, you know, from the PTAB to the CCPA appeal that's been going for a long time. And sort of and this is not something that's mentioned in Thomas' opinion, but the bizarre implication of this is that if you strip the Federal Circuit of Article III status, then all of a sudden we have a system that's okay, because we just have an Article I court and the executive branch reviewing the opinion, even though it's not accountable to the president, right? So so basically, right, the part of the opinion joined by four justices is just talking about how much supervision there really is in the system, nothing wrong with the process of appointment, and these officers act like, you know, truly APJs, like inferior officers. Then there's longer analysis, which is just by Justice Thomas, basically saying that, kind of historical analysis that principal officer status was never meant to, apply to low level officers like APJs, just kind of some founding era analysis, and also, you know, basically suggesting that Edmund has wrongly decided this whole agency theory, that sort of making decisions that bind or speak on behalf of the agency is not the right test for appointments clause purposes. And Thomas concludes his opinion saying there's something wrong when APJs are raised to the same level as ambassadors and head of department as the Secretary of State. And he just doesn't think that is supported historically. So so he's really questioning the Edmund case, on which the Roberts opinion is relying quite heavily. And I think, unlike Greg, I would say it does almost harden Edmunds into a rule, right, that speaking on behalf of the agency, because it's not clear what wiggle room is there. But Greg is right. There is definitely some wiggle room. It's not the rule, but it's a very, very important factor that, you know, the officer say a final word on behalf of the agency. So Breyer, so this is the Thomas opinion. I think Breyer, besides providing the key votes to save the PTAB, focuses on this language of as they think proper in the appointments clause. So Congress has given a lot of leeway, again, to design a system. By the way, also full disclosure, I signed a brief, I co-authored with Alan Morris and Mark Lemley, among others, saying that there was supposed to be such leeway in the system. And I think, you know, even though Breyer didn't cite our brief, I think it seems like some of the opinions discussed there, including some of his own other opinions, you also mentioned in the brief. So there has to be some judicial deference to congressional design. Even minimal judicial deference should result in the affirmance of the scheme, right? This is a very activist majority, right, trying to take things down without any deference. Right. So again, Breyer focuses a little bit on APJ independence and how some independence is important because of this is a sort of a technical agency, but it does remind us that there is a reconsideration power of PTAB opinions that director can initiate, and sort of just says that the Roberts opinion is very formalist in the way that is just not defensible, right? It's creating judicial rules. So to the extent that there is sort of a writing in or judicial legislation, it begins from the start, right? From the invalidation of the whole system, right? The court is imposing its own policy choices on the agency, unfortunately. He would take a functional approach, and leeway to Congress, which would be a good thing. And under that analysis, PTAB judges, APJs would be inferior officers. But he is okay with the remedy in the end, right? So he joins, he and the two joining justices, Kagan and Sotomayor, join part three agrees that, you know, the system, sort of that part of section six that Greg mentioned can be modified in such a way as to allow director kind of the final word on every PTAB decision, which I think the director already has, but now the director will formally have after this constitutional cure. So I think that's all I'm going to say about that. I also have talked for a long time and looking forward to further debate.
Great. Thanks, Dimitri. So let's move into talking a little bit about the implications, because I think we may have heard already what you think is right and what is wrong through your amici participation and what have you. One thing I was curious about, sorry, I'm just throwing questions out and you guys aren't expecting them. We practiced ahead of time and this question never came up. I was curious about this question. Greg, you mentioned, I think Greg, or maybe it was Dimitri, that Breyer and Sotomayor and Kagan grudgingly joined along to give the remedy the necessary amount of votes. Do you really think it's grudgingly, or do you think it's because Breyer doesn't like patents as much as I do, and saving the PTAB is probably a way to continue to get rid of patents, and Breyer doesn't like patents? I mean, I'm not speaking for Justice Breyer here, but... My inclination is he doesn't love patents as much as I do. So maybe it wasn't grudging at all. Any thoughts on that question?
I think it's a grudging in a sense, not that, you know, not that he's unhappy that PTAB is saved. I think it's a grudging in a sense that grudging that he has to do it in the first place. I think, you know, he would have been happier if, you know, if his view that, you know, this functional analysis, which of course he's famous for, but which, you know, for example, although I don't teach admin law, but I, you know, do occasionally teach other courses written by Justice Breyer, including NIP, it makes it just impossible to teach. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of, well, I know when I see it, you come to us next time and I'll tell you what's a good function, what's a bad function. And it's multifactorial test. It's true, as Peter said, Justice Breyer does accuse the Roberts of being, you know, very formalist. But, you know, as Peter was talking, I really wanted to pipe in and say, you know, well, you say it like it's a bad thing. You know, there are things to be said for bright line rules. It makes the life easier for Congress. It makes life easier for lower courts. And so in that sense, I think it was crushing. But yeah. I think you're right. I don't think Justice Breyer is a huge friend of patents or the patent bar. And to be frank, I don't think neither is Justice Thomas. If you look at sort of Justice Thomas's opinions over time, and you know, that perhaps is not super surprising. So Justice Thomas is perhaps the most libertarian justice of them all right now. And certainly libertarian community is very much of two minds. There are some people who think like, look, patents are real property rights and they're should be treated like any other property right and full stop. And others sort of take the view that patents are much more akin to these bad government grants of the, you know, where you sort of you give things to favored parties and you prevent the rest of society from doing things, and that's bad, and so we should limit it as much as possible. And so perhaps Justice Thomas has imbibed a bit of this kind of cup number two.
Yeah, I think I you know, to kind of go back to Kristen's question, I think there's definitely some real politics here. Just, you know, the fifth vote was lost because Justice Gorsuch does not like the PTAB and likes patents. All right, so Breyer and his two joiners have come in and, you know, and maybe, I mean, I think Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor's positions are, you know, maybe more general administrative state jurisprudence, but certainly there is that real politic there, right? I think, well this is sort of maybe the larger implications of this case, right? There are some that hope that sort of the patent, the whole PTAB system would get taken down. On the substance of matter, right, groups like U.S. Inventor have won, right, on the constitutional grounds, but it's still, I got an email an hour and I'm on the list saying, well, the Supreme Court affirms this horrible tribunal, right, because it's still in existence, right? And so I think the goal here really is sort of and take down the system by any means necessary. And, you know, I have 99 problems with the PTAB, but Appointments Clause 8 ain't one, right? And I'm not a by any means necessary kind of person. And to the extent that, you know, you'd need to distort constitutional doctrine if you like or dislike patents. So I'm happy that further harm was avoided. And I'm happy that Breyer provided the votes for that, just as Gorsuch withdrew his vote by probably his intense dislike of the PTAB.
So we kind of have skirted around a little bit about what this means for the PTAB, and maybe the answer is not a terrible much, but what are the implications that you gentlemen see for for both the PTAB going forward, and then also, is this going to change administrative law? Is this going to flesh out admins? Does this have no bearing on admins because the PTAB is its own weird little world, et cetera? So we'll switch things up. I'll give it to Dimitri first and then Greg after.
I think it will change administrative law to the extent that the part of admins where, say, having a final word on behalf of the agency, or as Justice Scalia's opinion said, right, render a final decision on behalf of the United States, becomes such an important factor. Chief Justice Roberts' opinion specifically mentions a Board of Contract Appeals and related bodies as sort of potentially in violation of the system. My government contracts colleagues are already freaking out not to put a kind of a nicer face on it, to say that maybe that whole system is invalid. So I think there will be scrutiny. There are definitely many or significant numbers of structures where there isn't that final review by an officer appointed with advice and consent that could create real problems, I think, right? And I think Edmonds, again, there is wiggle room. It's not clear what wiggle room there will be. Maybe there's, you know, general services administrator supervising the Board of Contract Appeal on certain powers, and maybe there's an easier fix. So maybe there isn't, right? I think here the remedy presented itself very clearly, right? The director is ahead. The director has reviewed the lower officers at the PTO before. In the trademark context, Congress actually passed legislation during the pendency of Arthrex giving that power to the director. So it seems like, at least as a matter of sort of congressional intent or agency structure, it was an easy fix. It's not so clear that fix can be made in other agencies. So I think it will affect the Ministry of Law. I think it will affect other agencies. And I think the next target is probably the Board of Contracts Appeals, where you have that sort of a structure. And the other thing I wanted to say in response to Kristen's question is that it's not clear if delegation of statutory authority, so if, right, the head of the agency delegates authority to judicial officers within the agencies who are not appointed by the vice, it's not clear if that's okay. There's a case that got litigated in the D.C. Circuit, Dobbs of constitutional issues, about judicial officers within the USDA that, you know, are delegated authority from the secretary but are not themselves appointed, of whether you really have to have review by the secretary for there to be constitutional structure of the agency. So there will be a lot more litigation. I think this case opens a lot more by basically saying it wasn't just, you know, loose language in Edmonds. We're not disavowing Edmonds. No, you really have to have some sort of formal review by an officer. So I don't think it's just a PTAB, because there are agencies like the PTAB, unlike, you know, as the chief's opinion acknowledged.
So I mostly agree with Dimitri. Like I said, oftentimes our disagreements are very much at the margins. I think our general outlook is very similar. And just to be clear, by the way, I'm also not by any means necessary kind of guy. I actually do care deeply about the constitutional structure and not kind of like endorsing cockamamie theories simply because I dislike PTAB, and I do dislike PTAB, but I did think that there was an appointments clause problem, and, you know. So in terms of its effect on PTAB, I don't think there's going to be much. I don't think the director's all of a sudden going to just, you know, start spending, you know, 20 hours a day reviewing every single PTAB decision and doing real kind of like dive into, you know, into the weeds. I suspect he'll basically delegate his authority. I suspect, you know, I'm a bad tea leaf reader, but I do suspect the delegation is probably fine as long as it's not a one-way ratchet. So as long as basically the director can say, okay, well, I've delegated, but now I've changed my mind, I can basically retake it. So as long as that director or any other sort of agency has, as long as that's fine, I think as long as that exists, I think the court would endorse that. So I think kind of so there's this question about kind of legislation writing and practical reality. I think for most agencies, the practical reality is not going to be that much different, as long as the legislation authorizing those agencies' operation does say that, look, it has to be made by the people who are the principal officers, even if they delegate. So for example, Social Security is very common. So the statute says it's the administrator of Social Security that makes the determinations on disability benefits, but they've delegated it to IPL's counsel, and they delegated it to ALJs. But nonetheless, the decision is made in the name of and ultimately by the administrator, who of course is Senate confirmed. One kind of issue that I would want to highlight, so Dimitri brought it up in his opening remarks, about independent agencies and kind of and the level of control. And so he's highlighting, for example, CAFC, where judges serve, I believe, 15-year terms. They're Article I tribunal, but they're not necessarily responsible to this president. It cannot be terminated by a particular president. And so, and again, it's kind of, it's one of those issues where it becomes hard, where on one hand, you do need this chain of command. On the other hand, in, there are some situations where you do want independence, especially when you do an adjudicatory thing, whether it's PTAB or the CAFC or whether it's International Trade Commission or whether it's like Court of Federal Claims. There are a bunch of the, you know, it's kind of, it is, it's very much of a, you know, tough balancing act. I think what potentially saves it is that at least once, sure, the people who currently serve on CAFC are not directly responsible and cannot be fired by President Biden. Same thing with CAFC and ITC, et cetera. But at least at some point, you know, kind of our country presupposes that there is, the presidency is a continuing thing. The president is not, but the presidency is. And so these individuals were appointed by the power of the chief magistracy. And, you know, they're imbued with that sort of authority by being appointed by this chief magistrate and confirmed by our upper chamber. And I think that sort of formal process, this kind of this solemn process makes it okay that they would render final decision on behalf of the United States. That having been said, I think truly independent agencies, right, aren't potentially ripe for, especially ones that do things other than adjudication, are potentially ripe for reexamination. And I think there have been rumblings in the Supreme Court, not in this opinion, that suggested that perhaps truly independent agencies where the president has almost no control, like, for example, say, FTC, where they don't really adjudicate. They mostly prosecute, they make rules, et cetera, but they may or may not survive this current constitutional doctrine. And I'm not so sure it's a bad thing if you have really an executive agency executing the laws as opposed to merely adjudicating, that is kind of just floating out there, not subject to anybody's political control. I'm not sure it's such a great thing. You know, I'm certainly open to arguments, but it's something that needs, I think, potentially another look. So yes, there's gonna be some effect on agencies, but I think it's yet another one of the pieces of the puzzle to try to figure out whether or not kind of this jurisprudence that will start with a new deal where you can have these sort of fourth branch, multiple fourth branches of governments, really is consistent with the constitutional structure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.